From 90.7 WFAE, this is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Crystal Hill makes her first public appearance since returning from suspension, promises to talk about it, but not yet. A new state audit finds that Katz has not spent the $1.7 million set aside for safety and that nearly two-thirds of riders are evading paying fares. Governor Josh Stein vetoes a bill that would shorten the early voting period in primaries. He calls it part of the GOP effort to attack our elections and the vote. And the two Republican candidates for Senate in South Carolina meet in their one and only debate. Our roundtable of reporters fills us in on those stories and more this hour on the Charlotte Talks Local News Roundup. First, the latest news. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Crystal Hill makes her first public appearance since her two-month suspension ended, but she had nothing to say about the investigation.
Today is not the time or the place to have that discussion.
The deadline approaches for members of the Charlotte Area Regional Transportation Planning Organization to decide whether to stick with their rejection of the I-77 toll lane. Some in Charlotte want further study, but that may not be possible.
We need more time. This is an impossible deadline.
Following a state audit, questions arise over whether Katz has followed through on safety improvement promises, more troubles at Mecklenburg's Sheriff's Department, and the Republican candidates for South Carolina's seat in the U.S. Senate, Darlene Graham and Ralph Norman, meet in a debate.
I'm a problem solver, a critical thinker, and a leader. I'm a volleyball mom.
I've got a proven record, folks. For 8 years I've been in Congress, I'm the most conservative member. You know how I'm going to vote.
And here to fill us in on those stories and more is James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Joe Bruno is a reporter for WSOC-TV, and Mary Ramsey is local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. Welcome to you all. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning.
Great. CMS Superintendent Crystal Hill, as I just said, made her first public appearance following her two-month suspension during an investigation conducted by the school board. Because we have been told virtually nothing about that investigation, it became, quickly, the elephant in the room and one that Hill discussed in her remarks at a back-to-school media briefing.
To ignore it or to pretend that it didn't happen would not be authentic, and that's simply not who I am. However, I want to point out that today is not the time or the place to have that discussion. Today, we are focused on the opening of schools.
So, James, when one wonders when the time will be for a discussion about this. Did anyone volunteer that information, when they will tell us something?
Yeah, so like with everything in this investigation so far, we don't know. We were told, Dr. Hill herself told us that there would be a time where she plans to provide more information at a later date, but we don't know when that is. We don't know what that will look like, how much information she will be willing to provide. At this point, we still just know that this involved matters involving administrative and operational oversight, which really sounds like it could be about anything. So we are still waiting to see when that moment will come that she hinted at this week.
She talked about being confident that the system would be able to carry out their plans for the year despite the investigation and her suspension. School Board Chair Stephanie Sneed has said in the past that she has every confidence that the board and Hill can successfully work together despite that suspension. And the school board has issued a statement several weeks ago stressing that parents can feel confident that CMS is ready for the school year and focused on serving children every single day. Is this a case of if you say the word confident enough, it will become true? Or is this really just something that we in the media are focused on and parents don't really give a rip? They're trying to get their kids ready for the first day of school.
I think parents have a lot of questions about this. I've heard from parents who have questions about it from the beginning of this investigation. I think added to the context of that, as we've talked about on this show before, it's just the fact of the frequent superintendent turnover we've had. I think there's become sort of this snowballing effect of like, why does this keep happening? Not just why is this specific incident happening? So I think there's a lot of parents out there who are concerned about this, who are worried about what it looks like for the district. And I think that, you know, being told that you're confident is not the same as feeling that confidence. And I think a lot of parents have a lot of questions still.
Well, as so many other things have happened in our culture in the last 10 or 15 years, confidence, we have forgotten, is something that is earned. It is something that is earned through demonstrations of competence, and it's something that is aided by transparency, which is something that has been sorely missing to date. And what happened after that meeting is yet another demonstration of the lack of transparency when reporters ask questions about what happened to school board member Cynthia Stone.
If, for example, the CEO of Kroger had an experience like this, do you think the grocery stores would close or open? They'd open, of course. And that's what we're going to do.
But stocks would plummet if that happened. Stocks would go through the toilet.
And then they come right back up. So there
Once they had stability,
this is
maybe
time
something new.
I
got
it. I want to go see it.
Why can't you guys
Hill.
Be transparent about what's happening?
Oh, thank you for your questions. We really appreciate your time.
I am
time.
Here to
you are,
see
there,
this.
There are nine school board members. Okay. Why can't you talk?
Thank you.
And off she went. Joe, set the scene for that. What was she asked that provoked that response?
We talk about confidence doesn't exactly exude confidence when you can't answer very basic questions, putting aside the Kroger analogy, which is not a proper translation of this scenario at all. You know, the questions that we were asking Cynthia Stone were not exactly hard-hitting nuclear questions. These are very basic questions like, do you think the superintendent is doing a good job? Do you stand by the investigation? Things that aren't subject to closed session matters, just general feelings about current conditions that could, in fact, provide parents with some reassurance that the school board and the superintendent are on the same page and that the school is going to start off well, but it did not. No politician ever looks good running.
Following that interaction with reporters, she did go off down the hall, and you and a gaggle of others followed her down that hall, asking some of the questions that you just alluded to. In fact, you, Joe, asked this question:
do you think the investigation was appropriate into Dr. Hill? She's got quite the record. Why aren't you answering? You can answer that question.
Because they've already been answered.
No, I haven't.
And after about a minute more, you asked that question again.
Why won't you say whether the school board superintendent, the CMS superintendent, is doing a nice job? It's not a hard question.
Y'all make your own decisions.
Wow. What are we to make of that?
First of all, it's not personal. This is our job. Like, these are school board members. They are elected officials. They place our superintendent that we pay with our tax dollars on leave only to bring her back. We got the purchase order for the law firm they hired. They're giving this law firm $100,000. There's a lot of money involved here. It is not a crime to ask what the heck is going on. That is all we are doing here. We need more than what we are getting.
$100,000. James.
Yeah, I just also want to note, too, I think when you also frame the investigation as involving administrative and operational oversight, that's such a broad terminology to try to separate that from back to school operations and say that you can only ask about back to school operations just seems like such a stretch, because it inevitably sounds like it could be related to back to school operations. I mean, if you're saying that this is involving the superintendent and her operational oversight, that's everything the superintendent does. It feels like those questions would be relevant.
Joe.
And more things can be said than what are being said. We're not asking you to go around the table and share what each one of you shared in this closed session meeting, but you can give us more. You can talk to Dr. Hill and come out with a strategy about, you know, what can you say? What do you feel comfortable releasing? Dr. Hill can say whatever she wants. And the impression I got from Dr. Hill at that press conference is that she is serious and she's genuine when she says that she is going to talk about this at some point. was kind of similar to the Johnny Jennings settlement because, you know, city council settled in closed session. Johnny Jennings said, here's my personnel record. Here's what happened. Here's my settlement. I could talk about this because it involves me. Dr. Hill is in the same situation. She can be an open book if she wants. She can share from her perspective what the school board asked her to do, what she was being investigated, why she had to, you know, get like attorneys involved here. And I'm hopeful that Dr. Hill provides the transparency that the community needs.
So Cynthia Stone, a member of the school board, was there. I believe the superintendent, the school board chair, Stephanie Sneed, was there. And I think two other school board members, James, were in attendance at this media briefing in advance of the first day of school next Tuesday. Is it normal to have school board members at that meeting? Would it be normal to have them all there or none there?
You usually do have a few members that are at this back to school press conference. I mean, I think still given the circumstances, it's still noteworthy that they were there, because obviously if there was some really apparent tension, maybe there wouldn't have been as many, or maybe none of them would have shown up. But the reality, Mike, is we'll get our first kind of public view of their relationship working together on Tuesday night when the school board meets again for the first time with Hill back in on the dais. So that'll be an interesting interaction to watch and see if any of this tension kind of steeps into that at all.
Let me cycle back to something you were talking about a second ago, Joe. We all know that when things like this crop up, whether it's the school board or the city council or other publicly elected organizations, they sometimes like to hide behind the fact that state law says that personnel issues cannot be openly discussed and cannot be disclosed to the public, because that's what the law says. Board Chair Stephanie Seed said herself that this was an investigation launched because of, quote, serious and concerning allegations about, quote, administrative and operational oversight, something you've already talked about. If we get no more information than we've already gotten, would it not be in Dr. Hill's best interest for her to share that information with the public herself? Because this is a blight on her.
Absolutely. I think it is in Dr. Hill's interest to share what she knows, partly because the school board brought her back.
She can share everything, including personnel information.
Assuming there's no NDA, and nobody has alluded that there is an NDA, and I don't think Crystal Hill would have been talking the way she did at that press conference if there were things she couldn't say. But absolutely, it's in Dr. Hill's interest to talk about this. And at the end of the day, she was brought back by the school board. So I bet there's a lot of things she wants to say about the past 2 months of paid leave. She was told to stay away from graduations. She was told to stand down and stop working. She probably has a lot she wants to say. She can, and I hope she does.
James.
Yeah, not only was she brought back, but when they made the announcement that she was coming back, they didn't even really clear her of any wrongdoing. We still don't know what the accusations of wrongdoing may or may not have been, but they said that they identified issues. So absolutely, I think it would be in her best interest to clarify, given kind of the caveats that the school board added in their statement about this.
It's fascinating to me that in 2026, people do not understand that you can't let something like this fester. It just gets worse. Pull the damn Band-Aid off and get on with it. Mary, you wrote this week about Mecklenburg County Manager Mike Bryant answering questions at a community event about county funding for CMS and whether this recent investigation might affect that funding. What did he say?
Yeah, so as many folks probably know, the county provides a significant amount of CMS's annual budget. So this came up, was asked by a local resident at this event. Mike Bryant said funding public education is a priority, that as of now, he doesn't anticipate any changes, but with the caveat that that could change as he finds out more information. I also asked him specifically if he or the Board of County Commissioners expect to get any sort of briefing on this investigation, what it was about, what the results were, because if you guys have been making clear, we really don't have any information. He said that as of Tuesday morning, when I asked him this question, that he had not been asked to arrange anything like that, but will certainly be interesting to see if we see more of a reaction from the county, again, considering they provide millions and millions in public funds to the district every year.
Yeah, the schools are their biggest budget line item, if I'm not mistaken. And as far as I know, they are in the dark about what happened, just as we are in the dark about this. And I'm curious if they will be able to be privy to information that perhaps the public cannot know because of state law. Will they be read in on that? And I have about 30 seconds.
And that's what I asked Mike Bryant. He told me as of Tuesday morning, there has not been any sort of arrangement for anything like that to happen. Obviously, that could change between now and by the time we're putting together the new budget in months Joe. From now.
Keep an eye on the auditor. My understanding is he is well aware of this drama, and it would not shock me if his office starts probing CMS.
Yep, and the auditor has said some very negative things about how Charlotte conducts business behind the scenes, and I'm sure he'll be interested in looking into this. One of the things that this has overshadowed is the purpose of this meeting in the first place, and we'll get to that when we come back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're here with James Farrell, WFAE's education reporter. Mary Ramsey joins us from the Charlotte Observer. She's the local government accountability reporter there. And Joe Bruno reports for WSOC TV. We started this hour by talking about the press briefing before the first day of school that was conducted by Superintendent Crystal Hill and all of the information or lack of information about the investigation that just concluded has overshadowed the entire thing, the whole purpose of this media briefing. So, James, what did we learn?
Yeah, so ostensibly this was about back to school. They do this every year, kind of give an update on some of the safety protocols that they use, teacher vacancies we always get an update on. There's 161 going into this year, which is 50 less than last year. They talked about some of the changes to tech policy that they're planning this year, which I know we're going to get into a little bit later as well, but that have to do with limiting screen time for kids in grades K through two. They mentioned some of the new schools opening this year. There's two of them. Cato Ridge Middle School is one of them. And yeah, basically kind of those basic operations things. They reminded parents to sign up for Parent Square, which is where you get school communications from, Infinite Campus, which is where you can get access to your grades. They have a new bus tracking app called Alpha Portal that they're trying to get make sure parents are signed up for. And then just the perennial reminder for parents to get their back to school paperwork filed online and register for school if they have not already. So kind of all the basics. It wasn't that different from how these press conferences have gone from the past, except for obviously this kind of looming specter of the investigation that was going on.
Okie dokie. So we are approaching the deadline for the Charlotte Regional Transportation Planning Organization to make a final decision on whether to reverse their opposition to the I-77 toll lanes. The member municipalities have to make a decision first, however. A few have already decided to support the lanes, but at last report, and correct me if I'm wrong, Joe and Mary, Charlotte City Council is maintaining its opposition. Remind us, Mary, what's at stake here?
Believed to be between about $60 and $64 million. That's how much money NCDOT says they've already put into this project and how much under the new state budget the municipalities who nixed the project would have to split among themselves and pay back if they don't play another Uno reverse card and go back to supporting this project at the CRTPO.
It's also rumored that we would perhaps lose funding for other projects or be put at the back of the line. And this project, if we wanted to move forward at some time in the future with I-77 toll road improvements, Mary, correct me if I'm wrong, this too would be pushed out by about a decade.
Yes.
Okay. City, thank you. Succinct. City Council's only Republican member, Ed Driggs, is Charlotte's representative on CARTPO, and he will vote the way the council tells him to vote. But he made a point this week of saying that council's transportation committee recently discussed ways to move forward.
I think I've made clear that I personally hope that we can figure out a way to get this done, because $300 million in corridor investment, $100 million in bonus money and so on, those are big incentives. And it's an opportunity to invest in a part of Charlotte that has been underinvested, frankly.
Although once opposition to this project became clear, NCDOT did allow the public to come in and ask questions and make suggestions on how to make this project more palatable. Driggs wants, however, to take another stab at it.
The two main parts of that are independent third-party engagement by the city, not by NCDOT, with the public, with interest groups, to find out directly, for my colleagues to find out directly what might be acceptable to those who have been opposing the project.
And other members of council also want an independent study to evaluate alternate solutions. Matthews Mayor John Higdon, who is an engineer by trade and who has been against this project since the beginning, said the problem with conducting a study now is the lack of time, given the current deadline.
There's no way we're going to have an alternative analysis done by our next CARPO meeting. And so we need more time. This is an impossible deadline to have a real alternatives analysis done.
So, Joe, why can't NCDOT push the deadline out beyond October?
Well, it's state law now. It's in the budget. The budget says that they have 90 days from its passing. So the legislature isn't coming back to save them. This is the deadline. Even if NCDOT wanted to, this is set in stone now. So the Matthews mayor is correct. There is no time to have an independent study a year time frame, let alone in a month time frame.
So why are we talking about it?
Because I mean, it's legit. They want it. Like they want to know what else they could do, if there is anything else they can do. It's just they're going to have to pay if they don't want to do this, or file a lawsuit. They're not going to get an extension they're not going to be able to put this off to study alternatives. They're going to have to pay or file a lawsuit if they don't want it and they want to go down that route.
So CARPO is scheduled to reconsider this project at its September 23rd meeting. Charlotte City Council will discuss this several more times before then. And we have a lot at stake because Charlotte holds 31 of the 74 votes on the Transportation Planning Organization, and we would be responsible for the largest share of the $60-plus million in repayments that the state has written into the law in the latest budget bill. So I asked Mayor Rob Harrington yesterday on this program if the city is prepared for that.
I think if we get to that point, the city will figure out a way to deal with the ramifications.
But he also said, in addition to possible penalties, we should seriously consider the potential investment associated with this project. The threat of paying back the $60 million is the stick, but he's referring to NCDOT's proposed carrot to invest $300 million on the west side, including the building of, or financing the building of, two grocery stores in what are now food deserts. Is that likely to affect in any way, Mary, whatever decision City Council comes to with regard to how they're going to vote?
We'll see how well that message comes across. I know there's been reporting from my colleagues at The Observer and some other news outlets that there have been some semi-private meetings happening between NCDOT and some neighborhood and community leaders, sort of pushing these incentives that you referenced. There's not a ton of official word yet on exactly what all of that would be, but like you said, definitely seems to have kind of cropped up, especially in the wake of the budget passing and putting this provision in as an incentive. But given there is still so much opposition in the community, there's no guarantee that City Council is going to change their mind here.
Do we have any idea which way they're leaning? And do we have any idea, because I've asked this question about whether the city can afford to pay back whatever those tens of millions of dollars may be, and I can't get a real answer from anybody. So do we know?
It was certainly a narrow vote to reverse things before, so I think that leaves a little bit of a crack in the door. That being said, you know, politicians like to keep their thumb on the pulse, and there is still a lot of opposition to these projects. In terms of the budget ramifications, I haven't heard a ton from the city on that. I did at the county level ask Mark Jarrell about it. The county remains opposed to this project, and he said it would create budget headaches if they do end up having to pay this money for the county. So it is, without putting words in the city's mouth, it is reasonable to assume, you know, it's a significant chunk of change that it would require some rejiggering in the budget process.
Joe, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could dip into like the rainy day fund. County tends to do that. But, you know, it's a lot of money. It makes me nauseous to think that, you know, this, you would have to pay tens of millions of dollars for this project. You know, I think a lawsuit would probably come before they would just pony up the cash out of their wallets. But you also have to think about, it's not just Charlotte. In many ways, like, I guess I'm more confident Charlotte would be able to find, as sickening as it is to say, like $30, $40 million in Davidson, finding $2 or $3 million. That's a ton of money for Davidson and for Mint Hill and these other smaller municipalities. So you got to consider that as well. Davidson's going to vote on their stance in September.
And some of those municipalities have already said, we're going to reverse our vote. We're going to say, go ahead, build the thing. Which means, does that mean that they would then no longer be responsible for their part of this? So we would then carry their burden as well. Is that correct?
Okay. You're absolutely right. So Monroe doesn't want anything to do with this. They're nowhere near I-77. They're like, we're not paying $2 to $3 million for this project that doesn't even impact us. It's a really interesting situation they find themselves in. You know, we haven't really gotten clarity from the city of Charlotte about how city council is going to handle this over the next month. Like, the agenda isn't out for Monday yet, but we don't know if there will be public hearings. We don't really know if city council will discuss it again. And if they don't discuss it, their pass vote stands. So then you got to look at Davidson and Mint Hill and see if there will be a majority of votes on the CRTPO to oppose or support this project.
Okay, so moving to another form of transportation now, light rail. Following the murder of Irina Zarutska on the Blue Line last year, investigations were launched at the city, state, and federal levels. One of those investigations was conducted by the state auditor, Dave Bolick, and his office. They just released their findings, and they called into question whether promises made by CATS about improving safety on transportation have actually been realized. What did they say? What did the study find, Mary?
Yeah, so two of the big things that this auditor's report sort of dinged CATS for is fare evasion, people getting on trains and buses without actually paying for a ticket. The state auditor's office encouraged the city and CATS to explore, the MPTA, to explore adding some sort of gate kind of thing that you have to get through, turnstile, to get on the train. CATS has said previously that would be difficult to do because the light rail system was not designed for that when it was built. Most of our train stops in Charlotte are at ground level. Usually if you want to have some sort of gate or turnstile, you need to have like a raised platform or something like a subway, like you see in bigger northeastern cities. Also dinged CATS for its spending, attributing some money in CATS budget that was allocated for security that went unspent. CATS did come back and say some of that money was going to longer term projects as sort of an explanation for that, but those were kind of the biggest things. In addition to the state auditor's office also released a preliminary report a few months back on CATS. They also raised questions about CATS selection of its private security partner and spending on armed security versus unarmed security.
Yeah, according to this report, CATS left $1.7 million on the table. They haven't spent the money yet. What has been CATS' response to that, aside from the fact that we have spent money, perhaps we haven't spent it where you'd like us to spend it, but we have spent it? Is it a fact that they've left $1.7 million on the table, and are they planning to spend that on something in the future?
The official response from CATS about that part of the audit report specifically said that some of that money was going towards longer term projects. It was not sort of something happening immediately in one budget cycle.
And getting back to the fact that they found that 60% of the riders on CATS are not buying tickets. They're just getting on the thing and riding it, and nobody saying anything to them about this. It affects revenue streams, but it seems it also affects safety in some way because it allows people to get on the train for reasons other than transportation. Joe?
So here's the thing that kind of shocked me about that is not only are people not paying fares, they're not paying the fines when they get caught. Last year, CATS handed out 2018 tickets for fare evasion, and they collected $550 in revenue from those fines. The fine is $50. So do the math here. What is that? 10 people, 11 people paid the fine for fare evasion? So
how do you explain that? How does CATS explain that? Do they not care?
They are looking to the future because they have the fare ambassadors that are starting in October. And they said that they are taking action to really crack down on fares. And the turnstiles and the gates that the auditor raised, it's an interesting point. St. Louis did it. It was hard, though, to take an open system and close it. I believe Brent when he says it would be hard, if not impossible, to do that in some parts of the light rail because of the way we designed it. I don't know how they do that, the convention center or some of the areas in Uptown. It's interesting to me, though, that Brent told us that they're not going to do it on the red line either, because you would think that since they haven't broken ground yet, they could build those into the line. But the way he explained it is it might ding them on federal scoring as well. So they're going to do an open system for the red line as well.
Brent is Brent Cagle. He's the interim CEO. Yes. He's been interim CEO of CATS as long as
we've been since alive. The light rail was built, pretty much.
Councilman Ed Driggs also says it's impractical to retrofit our red line and blue line, well, our blue line stops with turnstiles or gates. He says it would cost more to close the system than you would get in additional funding revenue. But people say, I guess the auditor's office says, it could make us safer on the train. But is that true? Because there are turnstiles in the New York City subway system, and there are crimes committed on the subway every single day.
Yeah, I guess it depends how it's designed. Is it a gate that you can jump over? Is it a turnstile that, you know, it's like a revolving door that you need to scan to get in? I think that when Kat says that money could be better spent on like police officers, security officers, fare ambassadors, you got to give them some grace here that, you know, retrofitting the stops to add gates and turnstiles, and if it doesn't really address the problem, then yes, that money would be better spent on security guards and police officers and things of that nature.
Okay. Governor Josh Stein this week vetoed a 17-page election bill that would shorten the early voting period in primaries and would allow voters to be challenged after Election Day.
So if you are lawfully registered, show your ID and vote early, some sore loser could still try to throw it out after the election is over. Your leaders should respect your vote, not restrict it.
Stein says it's part of an effort by Republicans to find a way to keep power. This bill would make changes to a litany of election laws. What reasons have the General Assembly members, Republicans particularly, since they all voted for it and no Democrats did, what reasons have they given for this bill, Joe?
Well, the big one, the big change that most voters are going to feel and see starting next year if they override the veto is the elimination of 7 early voting days during the primary and the second primary, going from 17 days to 10 days. And they said that North Carolina has the most in the nation and doesn't really need 17 days of early voting because it costs a lot of money. You know, the voters don't necessarily turn out all 17 days. They want to go to 10 days. And then in some of the other more administrative things, or the pitch has been election security, making sure that the auditor's office, which oversees elections now, has the ability to ensure that legal votes are being counted and improper votes are not being counted.
And the governor has called this part of a years-long attack by Republicans in the General Assembly on our right to vote.
The bill passed on purely Republican party line vote. Not a single unaffiliated or Democratic representative voted in favor of this bill. We can hold this veto, but we need everyone to show up and to stand up.
Of course, his veto can be overridden when the General Assembly comes back into session. What is he asking people to do in 20 seconds or less?
Contact your legislatures and tell them to protect your vote.
Okay. When we come back, we'll get the Republican House leader's response to this veto and his assurances that it won't matter. We're coming right back. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Support comes from WFAE listeners and United Way of Greater Charlotte. Celebrating 95 years, United Way of Greater Charlotte supports education, financial stability, health, and essential services. Details at UnitedWayGreaterCLT.org.
It's Charlotte Talks and the local news roundup on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. James Farrell is with us, our education reporter at WFAE News. We still have some education things to talk about. Joe Bruno's here, reporter for WSOC-TV, and Mary Ramsey, local government accountability reporter for the Charlotte Observer. We were talking about the 17-page election bill that Governor Josh Stein just vetoed. That veto can be overridden when the House and Senate come back into session, and House Speaker Republican Destin Hall has pledged to do just that, but not until after the November election.
If it's overridden in November, then there'll be plenty of time to do that. And, you know, it's important to remember that deals with primary elections. We didn't mess with early voting in the general election, although, you know, there are some folks who would like to see that done.
If this bill is as onerous as the governor believes it to be, Joe, why did they only fiddle with primary elections?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It makes me wonder if this was motivated at Republican on Republican battles, because Phil Berger, he lost his primary by 23 votes and he lost the early vote by 54% to Sam Page. Sam Page took most of the early voting period, which was lengthy. So it makes me wonder if Berger saw this issue from a different light. He was impacted by the extended period. He got crushed in the early vote. Is that a motivating factor at all from his perspective on why the early voting period needs to be shortened to 10 days? How would only 10 days of early voting back in March have impacted the Berger Page race? We will never know. So that is one thing that I am intrigued about. Certainly the primary is less turnout than the general election. I think if they tried to do this with the general election, you really would have to worry about lines and making things harder for voters and more inconvenient. It remains to be seen if this will impact primaries in a significant way like it would the general, though.
So let's spend a little more time on politics, because we need more politics in our lives in America. There will be a runoff for Republican candidates to replace the late Senator Lindsey Graham in South Carolina on the ticket in November. The two candidates in that race met, in the Republican race, met for their first and only debate this week. Darlene Graham, Lindsey Graham's sister, who is filling out his term, came out swinging, in a manner of speaking, against her opponent Ralph Norman.
And I think you're confused, because I don't know if you want to be in South Carolina or Washington, because you said you wanted to go to Washington to clean up the swamp. Then you wanted to come back to South Carolina to run for governor. Now you want to go back to Washington again to clean up the swamp. So what is it you want to do?
But Rock Hill Representative Ralph Norman took a different approach.
Main Street Washington is with her. They're not with me, nor do I want them. I've never been subservient to anything in Washington. Washington is broken.
So she's a novice. Norman has been around the block. Did it show during this debate?
Yes, it did. The national security question was the best example of that. Do you have that clip? Are you planning on playing that one?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, this is the clip that shows that it was not a good night for Senator Graham, and just the fact that she's been a politician for 10 minutes came out and showed that she answered like a real person who didn't know the answer to the question. And unfortunately, as an elected official, you forfeit the right to be a normal person, whether it's CMS or U.S. Senate. And the answer that she had shows that.
She was asked if Taiwan, which is a major chip manufacturer and a traditional ally of the United States and one that we have pledged to defend should they come under attack by China, which claims they own Taiwan, she was asked if Taiwan is important to U.S. interests.
I'm just going to be honest here. I'm not on national security. I'm not that informed on national security, so... But I do support the military. My brother was in the Air Force for 33 years, so I will do everything I can to support the military.
Now, on the one hand, she was asked to fill out the remainder of her brother's term. She did not. She has not in the past really involved herself in foreign relations. She was doing very different things behind the scenes. But she's now a sitting senator and someone who was very active in helping her brother during his time in the Senate. And he made no secret of his fervent support for the U.S. helping Taiwan. How concerning should that answer be to voters? And do you think it will be concerning to voters? Because she says that her voters are concerned about pocketbook issues.
I do think it is concerning to voters, because they have to make a choice in just 5 days, less than that now, about who they want to send to face Annie Andrews in November. You know, no one's asking her to be an expert, but that was far from, you know, having an educated answer on that topic. And it kind of, you got to look at her other answers in that context as well, because she was taking credit for the Russia sanctions bill and helping getting that through after her brother passed. And then you got to wonder, how much did she do with that? We got Trump coming to campaign for her tonight in Myrtle Beach. Trump is still endorsing her. Russell Fry is very influential from Myrtle Beach to Chesterfield County. He's endorsing her. Maybe all of that support drags her across the finish line, but she's got some work out for her.
Meanwhile, Ralph Norman was asked about the affordability concerns of many Americans and said that the war in Iran is a key factor in that, but blamed Joe Biden for what led to the war.
On lowering gas prices, we got to get the Straits of Hormuz opened. And the president has done a good job. He inherited a wreck with Joe Biden. So what he will have to do is move forward to getting, making sure the war and the oil prices are low.
Was that word salad, or am I missing things here? Because it seems to me that the Strait of Hormuz is still closed, so I don't see how he can say the president's doing a great job on that. What's he talking about?
That one was a little hard for me to follow as well. I think it's tough to blame President Joe Biden for the Iran war that President Trump authorized here. At the end of the day, I don't think there's going to be much daylight between Ralph Norman and Darlene Graham when it comes to being a reliable vote in the U.S. Senate for Republicans should they win in November. For what Republicans are going to have to balance is who is going to be the most effective representative for them and who is most prepared to assume that job on day one. And maybe it's Darlene because she's in it and she has the experience with her brother, or maybe it's Ralph Norman because he's been there for two decades.
So whoever becomes the next senator from South Carolina, either of these two Republicans or Democrat Annie Andrews, they will be in office at a time when they'll have to make a critical decision about the future and fate of Social Security. It is set to become insolvent in 2032. Whoever wins will be in office leading up to that. Both candidates in this week's debate were asked about that entitlement program. Norman said fixing it will require change.
No, we can't keep it as the way it is. Again, it's kind of like the cuts. We just haven't had the courage to tackle Social Security because we have worthless notes. That it's not like the money that is the taxpayers that's accumulating for them to spend.
And Graham said getting some recipients back into the workforce would help.
Social Security was put in place to protect our elderly from living in poverty. So we have to keep Social Security. Lindsay and I relied on Social Security when our parents died when we were younger. So Social Security is important.
Okay, but some serious thought needs to be given to this, and quick. Insolvency Day is quickly approaching, and the national debt just reached a record-setting $40 trillion, with Social Security adding about $20 billion more to the deficit every single year. Stay tuned. Mary, another problem has cropped up at the Mecklenburg County Sheriff's Office. A former detention officer there says she was wrongfully terminated after reporting multiple incidents of sexual harassment by a male superior, not Sheriff Gary McFadden. What's this all about?
Yes, so this is the latest lawsuit or legal venture filed against Sheriff McFadden. As you said, he has not been accused of any of the actual sexual harassment or impropriety. The accusation is that he and his administration retaliated against him, this employee, when she reported another employee for sexual harassment. The employee also alleges a culture of, you know, a lack of oversight, bad behavior from employees that goes unpunished. The sheriff's department's response is that this is a matter that was investigated internally and has been handled, but just the latest in a series of lawsuits filed against Sheriff McFadden over issues with the jail. There was the issue where the Representative Carla Cunningham joined earlier this year. So just sort of the latest step in the saga.
McFadden is not accused of anything in terms of sexual harassment in this, but he's the only person named in the suit. Why?
The allegation in the suit is that he has fostered a culture within the sheriff's department of bad behavior and retaliated against employees, like the former employee who filed this lawsuit alleges, who have spoken out about their problems.
So James Farrell has been sitting at the back of the classroom hoping that I wouldn't call on him again, but clearly I'm going to. Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools, as we have already alluded to, start the year on Tuesday of next week, and they will be facing new restrictions on technology. We talked a little bit about that when I asked you to sum up the briefing that took place earlier this week, but what are these new restrictions?
Yeah, so basically they want to reduce the number of benchmark tests which are taken on computers. They want to put new restrictions on K-2 screen usage. So they said they want to limit how often kids are on their personal devices to only when truly needed for the educational experience. They're planning on implementing a new rule that would prohibit YouTube on those devices as well for K-2. They're planning on banning screen time in place of physical activity during indoor recess. And they're also planning kind of this overall review over the course of this school year to look at how they're using technology, what their policies and practices are, and maybe reevaluating some of that as well.
And CMS Chief Academic Performance Officer Kimberly Vaught says these new policies are meant to focus the use of technology, not just to restrict it for the sake of restricting it.
Our focus is really on looking at making sure that technology use at all levels, certainly first, is developmentally appropriate, but that it is purposeful.
And there will also be a few teacher and bus driver vacancies at the start of the year on Tuesday. This is not unusual, but what is perhaps unusual is the fact that it's not as high as it normally is, correct?
Yes, so they said there are 161 current vacancies as of earlier this week. That's about 50 less from last year's first day of school vacancy number. And if you go back a few years ago, in the 23-24 school year, that number was as high as 500. So CMS has definitely made progress on this front. A couple of caveats to it, though. I had asked if there was a breakdown between new and experienced teachers. If you've paid attention to the board meetings, they often talk about how experienced teachers are kind of really important toward moving the needle on student outcomes. I don't have those numbers yet, so I'm not sure what that breakdown is exactly. Also, in the past, we've seen that number go down both at CMS and other school districts because they're eliminating vacant positions as well. So I don't have those numbers yet either. So a couple caveats there, but overall, this is still a much better picture than what CMS has seen in the past.
Meanwhile, the North Carolina State Supreme Court has ruled against ruled that a lawsuit against Charlotte Latin can proceed. That ruling overturns a lower court decision that had dismissed the case. What's this suit about?
Yeah, so this goes back to 2020 after the killing of George Floyd. These parents, Nicole and Doug Turpin, had alleged that Charlotte Latin started to teach more political content on things like race and gender. They started a group called Refocus Latin that was trying to call attention to these issues. They presented in front of the board with a PowerPoint. And then in 2021, they met with administrators at the school. It was kind of a heated meeting. Administrators had kind of alluded to some of the content in this PowerPoint that they found to be potentially, you know, racially charged. The Turpins have denied that, and they expelled the Turpin students. So that's where this lawsuit kind of stemmed from. They argued that they were wrongfully expelled. The lower courts had tossed out the lawsuit, claiming that the Turpins had failed to state a claim. And the state Supreme Court, as you mentioned, has overturned that ruling, allowing the lawsuit to move forward. It didn't rule on the merits of the case, so that still has to be figured out, but the lawsuit can move forward now.
The school says expelling a student, which it believes that a working relationship can no longer exist between the school and the student, is something that is within their rights, and the parents call this a breach of contract. Mary, you spoke with the parents yesterday. What did they say?
I am going to pass that on to my good buddy Joe. Because
sorry, Joe, you spoke
to the parents. That's okay. yeah, they said they're taking up this fight because other parents might find themselves in a similar situation one day and not have the resources to fight back. One of the key things that they hone in on is in the meeting before the kids were expelled, the father, Doug Turpin, emailed the administrators concerned about something his son was allegedly taught in humanities class. And he said, I want to make sure that my son won't experience any blowback for this. And the administrators responded, I can assure you there will be no retaliation. There will be no blowback because of you raising these concerns. And then he goes to the meeting and the students are expelled. So one of his key arguments is they retaliated when they said they would not. Charlotte Latin is really honing in on that enrollment contract that says when you enrolled your students here, you agreed to these conditions that we can terminate your children's enrollment if we believe the working parent relationship is not salvageable. And the worry from the Judge Allison Riggs, who dissented on this, is if this lawsuit is successful, it's going to have huge impacts for not just Charlotte Latin, but for all private schools, and how it could open them up to litigation about a lot of different things.
And that's what Justice Allison Riggs, who was the dissenting voice, one of the dissenting voices on the Supreme Court, said. James?
Yeah, this is just a really interesting case. When you go back to 2020, and there were a lot of these kind of culture wars in public schools where people were debating how things were being taught in the classroom, especially after George Floyd and everything like that. You know, it's just interesting to see this debate now playing out at a private school, which theoretically has more flexibility to kind of determine what they want to have going on in the classroom. So it's just interesting to see that dynamic play out here.
And finally, after 8 years of operation, Queen City Nerve announced it has ceased publication. Ryan Pitkin, one of the co-founder and editor of that publication, frequently participating on this roundup, had this to say about the economics that led to what must have been a very painful decision.
It's really tough out there. I mean, a lot of this is a shift in just the way that companies see how they want to run their advertising budget. But I mean, it's not just that. There's also so much economic uncertainty.
I have about 10 seconds left here, Joe. Queen City Nerve was kind of the successor to Creative Loafing. They covered government, arts, music, food, culture, and more. What's next for Ryan? I know he's a friend.
I hope somebody hires him as soon as possible, because he is a gifted reporter and talented government watchdog.
And another media outlet bites the dust, which is not a good thing at all. Mary Ramsey from the Charlotte Observer, Joe Bruner from WSOC-TV, James Farrell from WFAE, thank you all for the hour.
Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Gabe Altieri. The senior producer is Sarah Dalia. Our producer is Chris Jones. Additional production assistance by Emmy Berger. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to visit past episodes, or to sign up for the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.